So, Robert Phillips, you have been kind enough to be on this podcast because I'm doing, as you may know, a multi-part series on addiction, especially opioid addiction. But of all the guests, I am very excited about you because I think you have such a difficult job as being an intervention specialist. And yet your job also just saves so many lives. So talk to us first. How did you get into becoming an intervention specialist?
Well, I have over 23 years of chemical dependency experience. I've worked in the field. First of all, I'm a recovering addict myself. I have been for almost 26 years.
Wow.
I wanted to, once I got clean, I wanted to reach out and try to help others. And so I got into the field, went back to school, got my got my degree in social work, got a job working in a kitchen in a treatment program, and went up the ranks and eventually become the clinical supervisor of that program.
Wow.
And just like addiction knows no barriers. I ended up having an issue within my own home, in which my daughter had a chemical dependency issue. And in essence, that was my very first intervention that I had to do, was we actually had to do it with my own daughter.
Wow.
And after that experience, I made a decision that that there were other families that needed help. And I had a skill set, I had a knowledge that I felt that could benefit families, and so I proceeded to get additional training in the intervention process, looked at what worked, what didn't work, and over the past several years, I've been very successful at what I do.
So, yeah, get into that. What does work and what doesn't work? Because I have addiction, of course, in my own family. I mean, I think everybody does. And my brother is a recovering alcoholic. He's been 7 years sober. So in a crazy way, we kind of had our own intervention with him, but I'm not even sure if we knew it. And we'll get into, because I think I hear this all the time, but so many families enable the addict. But before we talk about that, tell us, like, what works in intervention and what doesn't?
Well, there are a lot of different approaches to intervention. The one that everyone is most commonly relates to is the one that you see on the intervention TV show.
Oh yeah.
And that particular approach is called the Johnson method. It is sometimes called Love First, and it was developed back in the late 1960s, early 1970s, by the Johnson Institute. And at that particular time, we did not know as much as we know about dependent disorders as we do now. And so at that particular time, there was a belief that you had to deflate the ego and then you had to rebuild it back up. There was a lot of treatment approaches. One in particular was called King Baby, in which clients went into treatment and basically there was an ego deflation, and then they started to rebuild back up. And it was based upon the idea that sometimes even clients would have to wear signs and things of this nature in the program.
Oh Lord!
Well, as we began to understand the disease of a model of addiction, and we begin to understand that this is a brain disorder, and the way it affects the brain is it alters an individual's perception of their world around them, and it also hijacks what we call the survival imperative of the brain. And when it hijacks the survival imperative of the brain, they're basically trying to do the very thing. They're just trying to stay alive. That's what the brain is telling them, that
right.
I got to stay alive. This is what it's going to take, is to use this substance over and over again. And we begin to understand that what happens is that the disease primarily lies within the emotional regulation part of the brain. And the way that works is the things that are necessary for our survival are linked to emotional responses. Things
okay.
like eating a nice meal. We all like to sit down and have a nice meal because it's enjoyable.
Right.
Sleep, even things such as procreation, sex, they're enjoyable because they're necessary, vital parts of the survival of the human species, but also the human race. And so they're emotionally charged. And so what happens is the drug comes in and hijacks that imperative, and it becomes the central imperative or the central survival imperative within the brain.
Wow. So, yeah, talk to us about that, too. And addiction is, like you were saying, because I guess a lot of times you sort of hear, is it a chemical imbalance in the body that causes people to be addicted? Is it, you know, something emotionally that they're trying to fill? But it sounds like it is more of a chemical imbalance in the body, right, that makes you addicted to a substance initially?
Well, you know, if you take a look at history, and what research now is really looking into, and there's particular science in this, and it's called epigenetics, and it's based upon the ideal that you have to research the past in order to understand what's happening in the present, in order to make changes in the present. And one of the things that we do find is that one of three things occur in the genetic lineage of an individual that develops dependent disorders. There is some form of other forms of dependent disorders. I'm talking about alcohol, drugs, cigarette smoking, gambling, even obesity, even workaholism and hoarding. There's some other form of dependent disorder that has occurred within their generational lineage. Some form of psychological or emotional issue, depression, anxiety, issues with anger, or there's some form of trauma, things such as early death, major losses, divorces, major life experiences, childhood experiences like physical, emotional, or sexual abuse, automobile accidents, even things such as major illnesses, diabetes, heart disease, or cancer. And what happens is that when these things happen across the generational lineage, the brain actually changes. And when it changes, it forms what we call, what happens it changes because it has to develop coping and adaptive skills.
Okay.
And when it finds an effective coping and adaptive skill that works well for it, then the brain will secrete a neurochemical, and that neurochemical is called glutamate. And what glutamate does is serves as a chemical memory. It helps us to remember in case we ever have to use it again. So, for example, my mother passed away, and it's been close to 20 years. Mm. I took it very, very hard. My brain changed when that incident happened, and when it changed, it developed some form of coping and adaptive skill, and it released glutamate. Yeah. Well, when I had subsequent losses in my life, such as the death of my father about 6 years ago, my brain released and went back to the glutamate, and the glutamate pulled it out, and I used the same coping and adaptive skill in order to help me to get through my father's passing. That's what happens when we experience this.
Wow. Wow. So tell me this. Tell me about the intervention, because I've been watching a lot of your videos and reading about you, and you say that an actual intervention is absolutely nothing like the TV show, which that's what drives me nuts. I'm in the media.
When I come in and I do an intervention with someone, first and foremost, I try to invite him. I try to stay away from the word intervention because it's a very, very loaded word. Mm-hmm. It brings up the connotation. Almost everybody has seen this show that has been on TV. Instead, my objective when I come in is that I want to get the individual out of the emotional part of their brain, and I want to get them into the cognitive regions of the brain, because that's the area of the brain where decision making has to happen. The emotional part of our brain is not capable of solving problems. All decisions have to happen in the cognitive regions. Addicts tend to want to try to solve things in the emotional part of the regulation of the brain. That's the reason they get angry, they get loud, they get boisterous, they become upset when problems are presented to them. One of the things that I use is I use the development of a genogram in order to pull them out of that regulation part of the brain and into the cognitive regions where we're developing that genogram together as a family.
Hmm.
And part of this is that I sit down and I draw out the family tree with them, And then once I get the family, and I'll do 3 to 4 generations. And once I do this, get it drawn out, I'll use color in order to distinguish one of three things. Other forms of dependent disorder, psychological and emotional issues, and trauma. And I go through and I talk about everybody in the family that may have ever suffered from it. And I show him or her, the addict, that they, in essence, may have inherited a backpack.
Right.
And that backpack may have been loaded with coping and adaptive skills that had been learned and acquired across multiple generations. And what science has come to understand through epigenetics is that genetics tends to load the gun, but it's environment that pulls the trigger. Something happens in their life, or a series of things happen in their life, and they simply respond the very, very best that they know how, given the skills that they were given. And when they got introduced to the substance,
right.
The event really is immaterial. When they get introduced to the substance, their brain is looking for something, and because it's looking for something, it grabs a hold of the substance and it pulls it into the survival mechanism part of their brain.
So tell me.
And so what it means is.
Well, I was just going to ask you to kind of talk about the ways that family members enable the addict in the intervention, because I've seen a couple of your videos and you sort of talk about that.
Well, the thing is that when dependent disorders move into a family, in essence, everybody gets sick. They get sick because what happens is a lot of times it's so subtle that as it starts to creep in, they start making adaptations along the way. And some of the things that families do is that we start lessening the blow. So we bail somebody out of jail, or maybe we pick up a particular bill, or maybe we give them a place to sleep, or we give them food to eat. Well, the thing is that, families view that, well, that's just simply love. Well, yeah, it is, but there's a fine line between love and enabling behavior.
Mm.
And a lot of times it's the perception that the addict is seeing at that moment in time. I'll give you an example. When I was in active abuse or active use, I would do things such as I'd lie and I'd steal and I'd cheat and I'd practice conning and manipulative behavior, and I got real good at apologizing.
Mm.
I'd come back and I'd even tears would be flowing from my face and I'd apologize to my family, and then I'd always wait and I'd wait for one little word. It's okay.
Mm.
And the moment that they said it's okay, they're telling me that they forgive me. But in essence, what I'm hearing and what my brain's processing is you just told me it was okay for me to treat you this way.
Wow.
And so therefore it gives me license to do this again.
So,
and so, the thing is we don't really, ever draw the line and say, you know what? The way you treated me is not acceptable. Therefore, I am not going to allow that to happen again to me. We don't set those healthy boundaries that we need to have.
Wow. So what do you recommend for family members? Because, family, I have it in my own family. I see it all the time. Family members really know what's happening, but they're very afraid and fearful to take that step. And I think my own perception is they're afraid to take that step because they're worried the addict is going to go out and go on a binge or really something is going to happen. So it's like, oh, I don't want to push them too far into their addiction. But what's your advice then for family? The minute they know this person, my brother, my sister, my mother, whatever, has an addiction, what should they do?
Well, immediately, the first thing that I always tell families is to gain knowledge. Knowledge is going to be key, okay? Because the addict knows how the drug makes them feel, but they may not have the information necessary in order to make an informed decision. I still believe that when you're able to get somebody into a position where you're able to have a cognitive discussion with them, then if you give them good information, they have the ability to make a good choice and decision. But a lot of times what happens is we don't come armed with correct information, and it ends up becoming an emotional response. You can't, remember I said earlier, you can't solve a problem with the emotional part of the brain. Mm. Families have emotional ties to that person, and it can, and they have to get into this emotional exchange with them, where they beg them and they plead them and they yell and they scream, and those are all emotional responses, and you're not going to solve it there.
We constantly now are inundated in the media, and this is why I wanted to do this series, that opioid addiction, alcohol addiction is at record highs in this country, that more and more people
Absolutely. Yes, ma'am.
Are addicts. So, okay, tell us why now. Why is that on the rise?
Well, opiates is a unique classification of drugs, okay? It is a classification of drugs that not only affect the survival imperative of the brain, but they also, synthetic endorphin. Our body produces natural endorphins, okay? These are natural painkillers within the body. Now, what happens is that when we get introduced to an opioid, the brain or the reuptake sites cannot differentiate what is a natural occurring endorphin and what is a synthetic endorphin. And so we take these drugs, or we take this classification of drugs, this heroin and the opiates. What happens is the reuptake sites receive it, and then they release other additional neurochemicals that inhibit natural production of endorphins. So the natural painkillers are not producing. And so they become more and more reliant upon this substance as the go-to. That's the reason that when people come down off of it, their body tends to ache. They get a flu-like symptom. It's basically the body is not producing the endorphins. It takes a while before those natural endorphins start coming back. And often, you know, it needs to be done in a safe environment, an environment where you have trained professionals who can be able to help manage those symptoms, so that the natural body production of endorphins happens.
I have two last questions for you. One,
sure.
do you think the show intervention has helped this, you know, people get sober, or do you think it's hurting the perception of how you help a family member get sober?
I think it does a little bit of both. I'm going to be honest with you. Any show that creates an heightened awareness to the disease of addiction, and I think it does a very, very good job showing how the drug affects the family, how it affects the individual, how their responses. The where I have difficulty with it is in the approach. Because I'm going to say this is that knowing who I am, and I'm knowing and working with a lot of individuals, how would you feel if you walked into a room and there sat all your family prepared to read all these letters and talk about how bad things have been? I believe in opening windows and talking about the possibility of what life can be like without the substance and how much special and greater it can be. I believe in leaving those doors closed, and those doors need to be opened in a therapeutic environment once a person starts treatment and they're able to address the things in an appropriate way.
And Robert, if you could if you could just wave a magic wand, what do you think would reduce alcohol, opioids, any sort of drug abuse or dependency in this country? Do you think it would be knowing from a very young age our genetic history? Like, what would be the solution if resources were unlimited?
Well, I mean, research now there is a lot of research that is being poured into it, and I think that the more we know about our past, the more we know about what is our genetic components, then that also can help us to have a perception of way things are could be in the future and how can we change it. The human body is very good for adaptation. I believe addiction is an adaptation that has happened in the coping mechanism of the brain. Just like it goes one direction, it can go back in the other direction if we return to certain key values.
Wow.
For example, the one thing that I personally see is happening is we're seeing the removal of the family dinner table. We're being inundated now with social media, cell phones, all of these things that are taking away the very human component of being aware and having those discussions on a regular basis with our young people. Having that dinner with the family and sitting down and putting the cell phones aside and sharing what's going on in your life today. Let's talk about the things. What are your struggles? What are the things that are going good? What way can we support us? We're put here on the earth, and our basic support system is our family. But that is where we tend to be failing our young people today. Is that we're not utilizing the resources and how powerful it is. Nothing influences a young person's personal decision-making ability than the involvement of a parent.
Wow. Oh, my God. Robert, you are such a godsend. Tell us, where can people reach out to you, find more about you, if they have any questions? Where can we contact you?
Well, you can, I work with American Addiction Centers, exclusively with American Addiction Centers, and the best contact that they can reach out to me is, our hotline number is 1-800-214-2649.
Robert Phillips, you are a treat. Thank you. You've been amazing.
Well, thank you. You've been very kind, and I appreciate the opportunity to be able to share what I can.
Great, Robert. Take care. This was terrific, and I really appreciate it. Okay, guys, you know I love you. Thank you for listening to the Hey Frage podcast. And of course, you're listening to Mindful Mondays. If you would head to iTunes, hit 5 stars, leave me a review, and tell me what you love about Hey Frage and my podcast. That would be so great. More to come on this multi-part series at looking at addiction and opioid addiction in our country. Thanks for listening.